She's come out with her second English language volume. The first one in 2011 was called Strada. And this one is called Contraband of Hoopoe. And she teaches at Colby Sawyer in New Hampshire. And I hope that she'll continue to maintain her relationship with Gloucester in the future. So Jeffrey, and this is his first time here, has published 5 books, including The Singing Underneath, a National Poetry Series winner in 1987. You don't look that old at all, Jeffrey.
57.
Yeah. You're 57 years old? You are not 57 years old. Incredible. Yeah. What have you been doing to keep Incomplete Knowledge, 2006, Into the Daylight, 2014, The Names of Things, Newman Selected Poems, 2006. And he has a very impressive list of awards, Guggenheim and NEA Fellowship, published in The New Republic, The New Yorker, The Nation, these kinds of publications. And I think that from what I've been able to find, like on the Poetry Foundation website, that Jeffrey's searching for a language that offers a kind of a clarity and a clarity for seeing things that are very unpleasant as well as things that are very sustaining. So without further ado, we'd like to invite the younger of the two poets up first. That would have to be Ava.
In my book, and that book actually is not officially out, so it was just rushed for that reading from Omnidon. And the protagonist of a book will show up from time to time. It's a hoopoe, that's what he looks like. It's a bird with a crest, native to Europe and Asia, but actually not America. And it's actually a bird that King Solomon sent to Queen Sheba to convert her to his religion. And then also hoopoe is the protagonist in a Sufi work by Attar from, I think, 12th century called The Conference of Birds. Okay, good, so I'll just start. So when I say a hoopoe, it's a bird. Okay, good. Sometimes people don't know because actually my publishers thought I invented the bird. And then they realized the bird actually existed. Can you feel the apparition? The hoopoe's wings beat under my blouse. The sound udut, udut, udut is stirring from my nipples. Pagan pole dancing. My breasts have Tourette syndrome. My breasts are in flux as if singing church hymns, kneeling down, standing up, kneeling down. I have to stop and soothe them with new lullabies. The hoopoe is the debug messenger chattering under my bra. This action is not unprecedented. King Solomon sent the hoopoe across the oceans to the Queen of Sheba to urge her with religion. Pliny said nothing about the hoopoe. On the other hand, Kircher in his Collegio Romano had a hoopoe in his collection of skeletons among bones of eagles, magpies, thrushes, and a Brazilian monkey. My valley of deprivation, my cloud of unknowing, pray for me, Upupa Epops. Convert me back to wonder. Cure my heart of such morbid desires to come home. It is you who take me across ocean, just as he once took all the world's birds on a pilgrimage to Simurgh. To a new land where jays are not jaded and finches do not fling seeds at small children. When I cross the border, I start hiccuping. The officer stares at my nipples. I carry wonder inside me. I bring abundance. I stir the wings within him. I buy a sausage at the airport before I leave Poland. Kiełbaska, kiełbasa, kabanos, kabanosik. This, my transcontinental dowry. The sacrificial baby of my tongue. Foreign gods hover over us. If God lets my sausage in, I will eat it like a saint, wreathed in incense, circle a table with Gregorian chants, Folkberg variations. The baggage carousel spurts my luggage out. With an air of conspiracy, I transfer this sausage from my carry-on into check.
I look around. I pray for my sausage while I move towards customs. The Angelus trickles. The Angelus salivates. Saint George is about to put his spear through a sizzling dragon. My luggage goes through a sausage scan. Can an old sausage be born young again? The officer pulls me aside. The officer holds my sausage to the light. His babushka trophy. It's a sealed sausage, I declare with pride. I've brought a new species. But you declared no meats, the officer says. Sealed sausage is not a meat. Sealed sausage is a sealed sausage, I say, as the guardian angels of my sealed sausage swarm under the investigation light. The officer blinks when I repeat with determination, a sealed sausage is a sealed sausage. He looks blinded. My hypnotic alliteration throws him back into the waters of his childhood where eels jiggle Scottish dances. O sweet detained sausage, saints of arrest, pray for us. May my new species have mercy on us. Escape at the borders. O oven bird whose migratory song is a sausage, a sausage, a sausage. Dear sausage of martyrs, sealed patriarch, let the virgin liberty swallow it. The first time we went to Bulgaria with our parents, it was 1978. There was no toilet paper in Polish shops. What is humanity without a decent roll of toilet paper? Every time I saw the toilet paper, I would roll it, secretly. I wanted to bring some luxury home. In Western countries, there was paper, but no truth to write on it. We knew the truth, but had no paper. No paper to wipe off the system. We carried it like a turf on our asses. What is the culture that cannot regenerate itself by healthy digestion? This is where we beheld the system. Not enough toilet paper to relieve our attitude. There is no good literature without good toilet paper. Ellis 1. They carried boxes, they carried goose feathers, they carried comforters, they carried Bibles, they carried candlesticks, they carried pillows, they carried voids and maps, they carried blue barrels of sadness, they carry a live goat, they carried barrels of pickles, they carry a honeymoon dress, they carried tweezers, they carried pins, they carried buttons, they carried crucifixes, they carry hand-painted Easter eggs, they carried the Book of Common Prayer, they carry pocket knives, they carried tears, they carry sewing machines, they carry donkey shoes for good luck, they carried luminous and dark duende, they carried children, they carry accordions, they carried ceramic pipes, they carry fears, they carry sheets, they carry wursts and pretzels, donuts, bagels, knishes, they carry the distance from what they loved the most, they carried vowels and consonants, they carried spices and intersections, they carried bed pillows, they carry bedspreads, they carried towels, they carry mangled boards, they carry rolling pins, they carry a spice shaker, they carry their grief into a hundredfold of grief, they carry their hopes into a hundredfold of hope. Do you read the hoopoe or are you being read by the hoopoe? Do you penetrate the mystery of feathers in feathers? The hoopoe brings silence to the world of noises. Each noise has an eye imprinted on it, and each eye is galloping somewhere. Each eye is riding its motorcycle. Each eye inhabits space by making tunnels. The hoopoe is a Sufi mystic who leads all the world's birds on a pilgrimage to encounter Simurgh, the ultimate mystery. But the birds steep in attachments and try to smuggle them on their journey. That weighs on their feathers. The nightingale smuggles love for a rose. The parrot wants to take the cage. The duck smuggles water. The partridge precious stones. The heron the whole sea. The owl treasures. But the hoopoe says, so long as we do not die to ourselves, we shall never be free. The hoopoe says, for how can you remain the master of yourself if you follow your likes and dislikes? The hoopoe says, set upon your way, for you are not an almond, you are only the shell. The hoopoe smuggles you into yourself. The hoopoe smuggled Solomon into Sheba. He's the courier of wisdom, correspondent between false infinities and infinity itself. Jan Karski, a Polish Catholic, dresses as a Jew to smuggle evidence from the ghetto. He takes with him his photographic memory. Light, bleeds and x-rays. He carries swooning eyes. He carries the debugs in the pores of his skin, in his pockets, the clouds of children. The porous streets, the ditches and sewers carry them. Pebbles of children in his mouth. These stones were feathers first. Red hair, feet of swallows, swollen crosses, red flakes. What trickles out of a smuggler's mouth? These children shrink into ripples. They trickle out of sewers into the other side, into their Christian names. They tap the earth. They are eggshells. He carries them to the land where honey and milk flow down the streets. He carries these debugs to the White House. In his palm, there squawks and whimpers. He places his palm in Roosevelt's palm. His ruffled feet meet Roosevelt's feet, leaning on a table. The swallows trickle out of Karski's mouth. The smoke of Roosevelt's cigarettes swallows the charcoal lines. Roosevelt, in his swallow-tailed coat, waits. His feet rock away the crucifixions. The smuggled Jews are noted down on the invisible 16th page of the New York Times. Invisible wrinkles on the page. A tree gets planted in his name in Jerusalem. Both Karski and the tree take the vow of silence. And that poem actually was pretty factual because it's about a Polish spy who tried to prevent Holocaust in Poland. And he got out from Poland. He actually did dress as a Jew just to observe what was going on in ghetto. And then he got out of Poland, went to England and tried to tell the world about it. And some Jews were even committing suicide hearing the news. They were unable to act, actually, and they didn't know what to do. And then he met with Roosevelt, who basically told him to wait, right? And then there was this note on the 16th page of New York Times. So Karski actually took the vow of silence. He was so dismayed that nothing was done. But in the end, the word did spread, right? So something was slowly being done. And he's slowly being recognized. There was actually an exhibition on him in New York, in the Holocaust Museum last year. I carried the twigs of the dead tree from my home street in Krakow as spoons into a bedding of combs, while muscular men with saws sing their funerals. The twigs wheeze, they wail, the spoons pebble my new kitchen. A spoon perches in my heart recurrently. An owl, it scoops out faces at dusks. Mere puffs of feathers. The hills palpitate as tails of deer flash. And light the candles. In what meadows, in what dusks, where does that tree reside? The hummingbird darts through the rhododendron. the spoon's pebble into words, and then into incense. In shoals of what other trees? I see them congregating on the highway, on another continent, in glow of red, burst into psalms. Alice 3. She takes a birch twig whisk, an x-ray of her land, for stirring butter, porridge, gravy. Birches make underground passages. They make new universes. They shed speckled skins. She takes the largest living organism. She carves new tastes into them. They comb the paths to new homes. They stretch for acres and seas. They shoot roots into clay dishes, into burlap floors. They tangle and mesh into windows. They whisk the curtain frills. They unleave. Winged forks from inside explode, scatter new letters into the air. They beat new wings. They take off. A bird of paradise out of the birch twigs. 47,000 stems from one root. Do you see a mulberry tree in a mustard seed? The hoopoe says, when you have the ocean, why will you seek a drop of evening dew? I smuggle her hula hoop skirts, queen of the oven and drawers, stuffed with candy, hysteric, who chased us with hunks of bread, upholstered in honey. Tsarina of household complaints, cicada of suitors, hippo of hypochondria, curator of covert farts, countess of church bazaars, my posthumous bride, now interred in a vat of poppy seeds. Babushka, grandma of flower pots dressed up in gold foil. How can I find you again in the bog of this world? 1974, an old man holds a votive candle at the Polish-Ukrainian border, an ancient wax figure, his skin a yellow paraffin. He came to Poland to get the candle for his grave. The religious votives are unattainable under the regime in Ukraine. The candle, a prayer, clasped in his hands. He carries the unspoken resurrection, kitchen and the apocalypse. The officer pulls the candle out of his hand and tosses it into the garbage can. Darkness, his candle. The dogwoods grow in silence. Who is the burning man? How can you know a candle from a moth? What illness springs from a lost place? Trees clasp their fiery hands. I smuggle a smoke film, ghosting. I want to carry him to the mother of exiles, to her beacon hand, a glowing candle. Your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. She lifts her candle beside the golden door. A poly candela, a drumming station. The intensity of the instance burns. A fire rises above his hands. I am 8. Some kids from the Ukraine visit us. They ask us for holy pictures. Any items of faith are forbidden in Ukraine. I give them the pictures of Holy Mary carrying baby Jesus, Saint Joseph, the guardian of poverty. They hide them in their cameras. Mary and her most sacred spouse are squeezed inside the box, x-rayed. They are reading Alice in Wonderland. The space contracts, the space of reference merges and becomes as thin as the photographic plate. They are developing the film, the saints. The kids carry the saints on their tiny shoulders. What do saints carry? Saint Teresa carries roses. Saint Catherine carries the wheel. Saint Christopher carries new maps, new avenues. John of the Cross carries the dark night of unknowing. Saint Francis carries animal. He helps me carry the hoopoes, pigeons, and hedgehogs. He pacifies the snakes under my chest. Padre Pio carries the stigmata. Saints transgress the law of customs. They smuggle wonder into infinity. The desire to never settle for less. How much time have we got? Are we good? Like two more? Or okay. So I'll take a sip. Well, thank you for listening. It must be dense and weird pronunciation, so it probably gives you a headache. The large blue dress took Matisse endless versions, repeated rubbings out of the areas of paint, etching, sinuous lines, until putrid matter is purity. The seawater interacts with oceanic crust of scratching colors, until the light bleeds into blue and not blue in its infinities. On the volcanic Azorean islands, locals make tiny flowers and nativity scenes out of scales of fish. Their layered rings reveal their age. Each canvas, a scale, a scalloped rock, unveils light years of porousness until blue beads from a rosary. Black basalt accepts drafts, flutings, lineations, missing cavities, strata, which in my language means loss. Okay, and the last poem actually refers to Katyn Forest in 1940, where 14,000 Polish prisoners of war were murdered by the Soviet secret police. So it was basically what Stalin ordered and Beria kind of executed. So they signed the liquidation papers. It was done at the back, like it was a secret operation, right? So for years, nobody actually was allowed to say the truth, right? It was blamed on Germans. So it was just kind of a huge genocide. And the poem also refers to, I think it was 2006. Well, let's see what my notes say, because I forget. It was in 2011. I don't know if you remember, in April, where the airplane crashed. And it was a Polish president, Kaczyński, with 90 other officials visiting the place of genocide. And the coincidence was that it was an anniversary, and then plane crashes, and then half of Poles think it was Putin, and half of Poles say, no, it was an accident, right? It was a fog, right? But people think Putin can even create the fog, right? So now with what Putin is doing, right, people are rethinking the whole thing. So it made me just write a poem. Emergency prayer. It comes in a veil. It waits under a black chador. It churns up grains, tides, whispers. Its feet are wounded, dark, banished nests, stitched wings of owls. Crucifixions are light years away from resurrections. Death perches in a fog. San Miniato carries his head across the river. It is the length of a toddler. March 1940, Stalin lapdog Beria types the liquidation documents. 14,700 prisoners of war, 11,000 other prisoners to be wiped out from the earth. Dogwood grows in silence. A fog rises from the dead, orphans the chairs. 21,000 swallows, the geometry of crosses. The trees in Katyn, red relics, candles, cranes at dusk. Infrared incisions, ghost rays. Pentimento. Their backs, cradles, oysters sealed up. The true enunciation happens in the dark. It empties the chairs. It sits on a camphor tree. Buttons from coats and uniforms, wedding rings, brass buttons, pieces of a rosary, buttons, a letter from a child, a letter from a wife, buttons, medallions, scapulars. A father and his son on the same death list. Все равно, the officer says. The father goes. He leaves for his son a Madonna he drew in the wood. The Virgin is a small, wizened girl with shrunken halo. She carries eternity in her walls. Her veil will lift once a week to reveal an icon. In the clouds, in branches, in this blue mandorla, a polycandela, the whole forest lit with blue gas rooms. Death comes in a veil. It waits under a black chador. It churns up grains of tides and whispers. On a branch it perches, on an invisible stretcher. It sits on a log and pounds. It is a drumming station. It sits on a log and pounds its wings. The dogwood hears. Thank you.
That was wonderful. I want to thank Ava for that reading. I want to thank Henry for inviting us and David for introducing us. I'm going to read from this new book. It's pretty new, April. I'm going to start near the beginning. There's a few poems near the beginning that are very simple. I was sort of trying to write the simplest poem possible. Partly because I was reading John Clare, the Romantic poet. There's a couple of different sort of homages to other writers in here, and John Clare is one. So this poem is just about seeing a rabbit in my backyard. We were talking about animal poems at dinner, so I thought I would read one or two. It's also an homage to John Clare, who you probably know, some of you, that he wasn't as well known as Keats and Shelley and Wordsworth and Byron. He was a real peasant, and he also suffered from some mental illness, which this poem touches on a little bit. For Clare. I saw a brown shape in the unmown grass, half hidden in a tuft. And crouching down to get a closer look, I found a young rabbit, no bigger than my hand, trembling there in its makeshift nest. And I thought of John Clare. This was one of his creatures in my own yard, pressed close to the earth, timid and alone, almost a visitation from the bard of the fallow field and the green meadow, who loved the things of nature for what they are. It didn't run away when I parted the grass and stroked its soft fur, but quivered in fear, the arteries in its small translucent ears glowing red, its dark eyes wide. I thought of keeping it, at least for a few days, feeding it bread and lettuce, giving it water from an eyedropper. Then it did run away in little bounds to the edge of the woods and into the woods. I thought again of Clare, how after he escaped from the asylum, he walked almost 100 miles home, lost, delusional, beyond anyone's care, waking soaked in a ditch beside the road, so hungry that he fed himself on grass. This book was written. My last book had a lot of poems about my brother's suicide in it, and this book doesn't really write about that much, but I feel like in a sort of general way, it's about re-engaging with the world in the decade after that, which, and so that some of the poems are sort of less, they're keeping the world a little bit at arm's length, and others are more engaged. And just as a contrast with that one, I'll read one where there's a lot more action with the animal. We were talking about D.H. Lawrence's snake poem. This is called To a Snake. It's much shorter than Lawrence's poem. I knew you were not poisonous when I saw you in the side garden. Even your name, Milk Snake, sounds harmless, and yet your pattern of copper splotches outlined in black frightened me, and the way you were coiled in loops. And it offended me that you were so close to the house and clearly living underneath it, if not inside in the cellar where I have found your torn shed skins. You must have been frightened too when I caught you in the webbing of the lacrosse stick and flung you into the woods, where you landed dangling from a vine-covered branch, shamelessly twisted. Now I am the one who is ashamed, unable to untangle my feelings, braided into my DNA or buried deep in the part of my brain that is most like yours. I don't think anybody else has ever used a lacrosse stick in that manner, but it was pretty effective. All right, so here's one of the other homages, if I can find it. It's to Gerard Manley Hopkins. I did a talk on him a few years ago, and I read a couple of biographies, and one of them talked about this penance that he performed when he was, you know, studying to become a priest, which was to try not to look at things because he got so much pleasure from them. So it was called custody of the eyes, and that phrase just kind of entered my brain, and eventually I wrote this poem. Custody of the eyes. To look at the world with devotion, giving all of himself to what was given, sometimes gave him so much pleasure, he thought it must be a sin, distracting him from his devotion to God. Therefore, the eyes had to be taken into custody like a pair of criminals, kept in the flesh and bone cell of the head, their gaze cast down in penitence. The eyes themselves watched over to prevent them from looking at anything more than was needed to get through the day. For weeks or months at a time, and once for half a year, he denied himself the beauty he knew more acutely than others, as if reducing each thing, flower, stone, bird, to a single word, stripping it of the singularity he loved to describe in rushing phrases that spilled down his journal's pages. But when the penance ended, his sight flew out into the open sky and over the fields, innocently coming to rest on each self-expressing element of creation with such delight and gratitude, he couldn't keep the words from pouring out of him. Okay, this is a little bit different. John Malkovich lives in Cambridge, Massachusetts, which I discovered when I saw him in a store. And so this is sort of about a celebrity sighting, but it's also about my brother, who was really into Malkovich's first movie, which was Sam Shepard's True West. So this is a little bit longer, 3 pages. It's called Encounter with John Malkovich. When I spot him in Tower Records 2 aisles over, flipping through bins of discounted CDs at their going out of business sale, his shaven head half covered by the hood of his gray sweatshirt, my first thought is I want to tell my brother, but my brother is dead. And yet I watch him furtively, searching for some Malkovichian quirk, some tick that might make Andy laugh, but he isn't giving anything away besides his slightly awkward stoop over the racks. Then it comes to me that if I can't tell my brother about John Malkovich, I can tell John Malkovich about my brother, and my heart starts pounding. Normally, I don't believe in pestering celebrities, but there are exceptions. If Spalding Gray walked in right now, I would definitely talk to him, but that's impossible, since he, like my brother, though under very different circumstances, killed himself. But John Malkovich is alive and standing right over there, and my mind is racing ahead to the two of us leaving the record store together, then having coffee at a nearby diner, where I am already telling him how my brother was obsessed with the movie of Sam Shepard's True West, and especially with him, John Malkovich, playing Lee, the older of two brothers. How Andy, who was my older brother, loved to imitate Malkovich, or rather Lee, everything from his small off-kilter mannerisms to his most feral outbursts, but even then he'd be smiling, unable to hide his delight. And how every Christmas he brought the video to our parents' house in Ohio, and our parents would groan when they walked through the room and sigh, "Not this again," or call it the most un-Christmassy movie ever made. Which is probably true, but for us, him and me, our other brother and our sister, but especially him, you'd have to say it was our It's a Wonderful Life. And I have to tell him how Andy used to cue the tape up to ask, "Can we just watch this one scene before whatever it was we were about to do, go out for dinner or visit our demented grandmother?" And we'd watch him, John Malkovich, standing on a chair shouting pronouncements or destroying a typewriter with a golf club. And we'd go off laughing and exhilarated to our appointed errand, his inflections ringing in our ears. But now it's something about the way he thoughtfully considers his purchases, shuffling through them, then putting one back, reconsidering, his hand hesitating over the bins, that somehow reminds me of Andy and makes me certain Malkovich would be interested in him, a sympathetic character if there ever was one, funny, gentle, a lover of dogs and kids who had neither, with an odd sense of humor and some mostly unobtrusive symptoms of obsessive compulsive disorder, who, like Lee, but to a much lesser degree, or so we thought, had trouble placing himself in the world. A part I'm certain Malkovich could play, all of it coming full circle, Malkovich playing Andy, playing Malkovich playing Lee, or just Malkovich playing Andy, bringing him back to life the way Lee suddenly springs back up at the end of the movie, alive after all, menacing his death, the phone cord still wrapped around his neck. It turns out that John Malkovich and I do leave the store together. We check out at the same time, two registers apart, then head for the door, the moment coming to a peak for me as I realize my last chance is about to slip away. But Malkovich, in front of me, has to wait there while a stream of people coming in briefly blocks his exit, and I watch in profile his flurry of impatient blinking. Or is it a display of exaggerated patience, each blink counting off the seconds he is forced to wait, or the number of customers going by him, not recognizing him, it seems to me, though his hood is down by now. And I think this is it. This little fit of blinking is the thing Andy would delight in most, the one detail he would rewind the tape to see again. And here's a shorter poem, partly about my brother and partly about my son. It's called A Drink of Water. When my 19-year-old son turns on the kitchen tap and leans down over the sink and tilts his head sideways to drink directly from the stream of cool water, I think of my older brother, now almost 10 years gone, who used to do the same thing at that age. And when he lifts his head back up and, satisfied, wipes the water dripping from his cheek with his shirt sleeve, it's the same casual gesture my brother used to make. And I don't tell him to use a glass the way our father told my brother, because I like remembering my brother when he was young, decades before anything went wrong. and I like the way my son becomes a little more my brother for a moment through this small habit born of a simple need, which, natural and unprompted, ties them together across the bounds of death and across time, as if the clear stream flowed between two worlds and entered this one through the kitchen faucet, my son and brother drinking the same water. Everybody probably writes poems in here, right? Since this is the... it might be interesting to you that that poem used to have one more stanza, and I suddenly realized that it was better without it. So Ava read an airport poem. I will read an airport poem. This takes place in Logan Airport. It's called The Day You Looked Upon Me as a Stranger, and it's one of those poems where the title is kind of the first line. The day you looked upon me as a stranger, I left you at the gate to buy a newspaper, and on my way back stopped at a bank of monitors to check the status of our flight to London. That was when you noticed a middle-aged man in a brown jacket and the green short-brimmed cap I'd bought for the trip. It wasn't until I turned and walked toward you that you saw him as me. What a nice-looking man, you told me you'd thought. Maybe European with that unusual cap. Somebody you said you might want to meet. We both laughed, and it aroused my vanity that you had been attracted to me afresh, with no baggage. A kind of affirmation. But doubt seeped into that crevice of time when you had looked upon me as a stranger, and I wondered if you'd pictured him as someone more intriguing than I could be after decades of marriage, all my foibles known. Did you have one of those under-the-radar daydreams of meeting him, hitting it off, and getting on a plane together? In those few moments, did you imagine a whole life with him? And were you disappointed or glad to find it was only the life you already had? So when I showed that to my wife, she said she liked the poem, but that she did not have that fantasy. I don't know if she's telling the truth or not. Let's see. How am I doing for time? Okay? Well, here's... I'll go from the airport to the Department of Motor Vehicles. Another depressing place. It's called Renewal. At the Department of Motor Vehicles to renew my driver's license, I had to wait 2 hours on one of those wooden benches, like pews in the Church of Latter-day Meaninglessness, where there is no stained glass, no windows at all, in fact, no incense other than stale cigarette smoke emanating from the clothes of those around me, and no sermon, just an automated female voice calling numbers over a loudspeaker. And one by one, the members of our sorry congregation shuffled meekly up to the pitted altar to have our vision tested or to seek redemption for whatever wrong turn we'd taken, or pay indulgences, or else be turned away as unworthy of piloting our own journey. But when I paused to look around, using my numbered ticket as a bookmark, it was as if the dim fluorescent light had been transformed to incandescence. The face of the Latino guy in a ripped black sweatshirt glowed with health, and I could tell that the sulking white girl, accompanied by her mother, was brimming with secret excitement to be getting her first license, already speeding down the highway, alone, with all the windows open, singing. Maybe I'll just read three more. Is that a good? This one was inspired by this news item that you might have heard on NPR or read in the newspaper. These British computer scientists somehow determined that April 11th, 1954 was the most boring day of the 20th century. Did anybody hear that? Anyway, so I did a little research and wrote this poem, which is really not typical of my poems at all, but it's called The Day Nothing Happened. On that day in history, history took a day off. Current events were uneventful. Breaking news never broke. Nobody of any import was born or died. If you were born on that day, bask in the inverted glory of your unimportance. No milestones, no disasters. The most significant thing going on was a golf tournament, the Masters. It was a Sunday. In Washington, President Eisenhower, whose very name induces sleep, practiced his putt on the carpet of the Oval Office, a little white ball crossing and recrossing the presidential seal like one of Jupiter's moons or a hypnotist's watch. On the radio, Perry Como was putting everyone into a coma. But the very next day in New York City, Bill Haley and his Comets recorded Rock Around the Clock, and a few young people began to regain consciousness. While history, like Polyphemus waking from a one-day slumber, stumbled out of his cave, blinked his giant eye, and peered around for something to destroy. Because that's what history does, right? Somebody wrote me an email saying that he was upset that I disparaged Perry Como, and I don't really mean any harm. I mean, and that the Masters was really exciting that year, so I had it all wrong. Okay, I'll read two more. So this is another one of the homages to another writer, and this is Virginia Woolf, who I didn't read until I was almost 50, and boy, is she great. So this is about listening to the Lighthouse on CD in my car while having the book in the passenger seat. I've done that like three times now. It's called Listening to Virginia. Driving around town doing errands, I almost have to pull to the side of the road because I can't go on another minute without seeing the words of some gorgeous passage in the paperback I keep on the passenger seat. But I resist that impulse and keep listening until it is almost Wolf herself sitting beside me, like some dear great aunt who happens to be a genius, telling me stories in a voice like sparkling waves and following eddies of thought into the minds of other people sitting around a dinner table or strolling under the trees, pulling me along in the current of her words like a twig riding a stream around boulders and down foaming cascades, getting drawn into a whirlpool of consciousness and sucked under, swirling into the thoughts of someone else, swimming for a time among the reeds and glinting minnows before breaking free and popping back up to the surface, only to discover that in my engrossment I've overshot the grocery store and have to turn around. And even after I'm settled in the parking lot, I can't stop but sit there with the car idling, because now she is going over it all again, though differently this time, with new details or from inside the mind of someone else, as if each person were a hive with its own murmurs and stirrings, and that we visit like bees, haunting its dark compartments, but reaching only so far, never to the very heart, the queen's chamber, where the deepest secrets are stored, and only there to truly know another person. Though the vibrations and the dance of the worker bees tell us something, give us something we can take with us as we fly back out into honeyed daylight. And then I'll end with the last poem in the book, which is, the book starts with a poem about flowers, and it ends with a poem about flowers, but the one at the beginning is all about not screwing around with the flowers, either figuratively or literally, like leaving them alone, not describing them with too many metaphors. And then this is sort of the opposite. It's about trying to transplant foxgloves from the Adirondacks to Massachusetts. And they only live for 2 years. And the second year they bloom and hopefully go to seed. But the bees weren't finding them that first year. And I wanted them to go to seed. So I got a little obsessed with that. And then I got a little outlandish with some of the stuff in the poem. It's called Cross-Fertilization. It's come to this. I'm helping flowers have sex. Crouching down on one knee to insert a Q-tip into one freckled foxglove bell after another, without any clue as to what I'm doing. Which, come to think of it, is always true the first time with sex. And soon Randy Newman's early song, Maybe I'm Doing It Wrong, is running through my head as I fumble and probe, golden pollen tumbling off the swab. I transported these foxgloves from upstate New York, where they grow wild, to our backyard in Massachusetts, and I want them to multiply, but the bumblebees, their main pollinators, haven't found them, and I'm not waiting around. The only diagram I found online portrayed a flower in cross-section, the stamens extending the loaded anthers toward the flared opening, but the text explained the female sexual organs are hidden. Of course they are. Which leaves me in the dark, transported back to a state of awkward if ardent unenlightenment, a complete beginner, figuring it out as I go along, giggling a little and humming an old song as I stick the Q-tip into another flower as if to light the pilot of a gas stove with a kitchen match, leaning in to listen for the small, quick gasp that comes when the flame makes contact with the source. Thank you for listening.